die 17. Bildkunst-Kameragespräche mit dem Träger des Marburger Kamerapreises 2015, Ed Lackman. Das dritte Gespräch führte Professor Dr. Fabienne Liptai. Die Sichtung des Films Light Sleeper von Paul Schrader wird empfohlen.
Herzlich willkommen. Very warm welcome to the audience, but I suppose you've been here for the last days. And Ed Lackman, thank you very much for being here, for talking to me, and yes, for joining us for the third and last round of the camera talks. Before, yes. And also, thank you very much for this lovely film. It's I suppose it's a very important film for you because you've referenced it in the last talks. You said a few words about it, and it has a gorgeous beginning with a cab driving in the streets. And I really admire a lot how you created a New York that is already an interior landscape from the first second on. And I like the way that the cab drives because it goes slower than the rest, so you kind of get the feeling that you're falling behind or dropping back. So there's something very slow about it, something very sleepy right from the beginning. And yes, and the reflections on the window, so there are many things, but maybe could you tell us a little how you lit the scene and yes, and how you came to perceive the images for this beginning?
Well, you told me. I never thought about that. The overcranking. You know, there's always practical reasons why you do things. So that was a cobblestone street like you have here. And just on a practical level, I was worried that the camera would be too jittery. So I suggested to Paul, why don't we shoot at a higher frame rate, like 30 or 32 frames? But it's interesting. I never thought about that sets up like the feeling of this like light sleeper, like he's walking. The only other like added little thing was his reflection in the window. This is like around 3 or 4 in the morning, and Paul had the idea about, again, like, can we get his reflection on the window? Well, it's a cab or a car like that has a curved window, so it's very difficult to get a reflection on a window that way, because it's always the relationship of the object to a surface, and then you have to angle the camera that way. So, as New York crews are very ingenious, the only place we could find a flat piece of glass at that hour was a telephone booth. So they disassembled the telephone booth in about 10 minutes, and then we placed it on an arm outside the real window, rolled down the real window, and angled it to the camera position and got that reflection. So, you know, things happen out of practical reasons, and then we can all talk about aesthetic reasons later. So there were two practical reasons. One, how do I get a reflection? And two, how do I get a steady shot? But I'm glad to know that there was an aesthetic reason.
I'm sure there is, as you said.
And no cell phone. It was before cell phone.
You know.
Yes, the best inventions come from improvisation on the spot.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yes, and of course, there's a strong reference to Taxi Driver. It's supposed to be like a continuation of this character who's changed the backs from the front seat to the back seat. That's Schrader's explanation when he wrote the script. And of course, it's a film noir, or it has at least a very noirish feeling to it. And there are many strong blacks. Can you tell us about the darkness in the first images?
Well, like working with Paul, is like going to film school because he loves to reference other work. And actually, he always likes to look at early Antonioni, and he looked at La Ventura and La Nota and Eclipse. And a lot of the shots of Willem is from behind. So you feel like someone is like encroaching him, or he's being followed, to create this kind of paranoid state. And yeah, there's a reference kind of to the neo-noir of the 70s, and so it's dark. And but again, you know, we were talking about how to use color and movement to create the psychological state. The idea was that something is imminent around these people. This is, you know, in a bigger concept or idea is, this is a midlife crisis of this drug dealer. Well, he would have come out of the 60s. In the 60s, idea of like drugs were that they were going to enlighten us and open doors. Well, drugs by that time had, you know, become crack and heroin. And so, and then also the metaphorical images of garbage. It's like the emotional garbage that these people are facing in their lives. And even that she wants to create a cosmetic company as something to cover, you know, the emotional scars of these characters. So these are all ideas, you know, you play with, and then what comes out visually is what you hope translate those ideas.
And you filmed with on location in New York, in the streets, of course, and with the light that was there, or?
Well, I always, this kind of film, I don't like to see lighting for lighting. There's the wonderful thing about shooting in New York, there is so much available light in the streets that you can implement the lighting and still make it feel like it's the actual lighting. Mm. And, you know, him driving in the limo, I had lights on other cars driving by. And a lot of times the car was free, it wasn't with a camera car. So again, I was trying to mimic the way lighting was in the streets without making it look like, you know, I was lighting it per se. And then playing with color temperature in the streets and, you know, not being worried about keeping it a dark film. And
Yes, well, I will talk about colors in the next minutes. And one color that I especially was fascinated by when watching your films was the skin color also. I thought that you had been a director of photography for many films that deal with the differences of skin colors also, and I do not know if it's a coincidence. And there are not so many directors of photography that I know that are so attached to the skin and to the there's this wonderful word in English, complexion, not only meaning the color but also the texture of skin. And you were a DOP for Mississippi Masala, for Meera Nair, dealing with a love story between an Indian woman and an Afro-American American living in the south of the States. And you use different film stocks and different lighting to bring about the different shades of their dark colored skins, which of course makes a social difference, a big social difference also. And there's a lot of skin in Ken Park, of course, naturally, in the very graphic scenes. And in Far From Heaven, it's not so naturalistic. It's they're wearing a coloured makeup, and you go very far. Like you said, you've been inspired by German Expressionism, and on some occasions, you really see that there's this purplish makeup on the skin. A very strong deviation from the natural skin color. And here in The Light Sleeper, the skin is very white. So could you tell us a little bit about this?
The overall concept with the lighting was these people would live at night, they'd be up, and at day they'd be sleeping. So they've inverted their time frame for... So I felt that could also give an indication for me about how the lighting should be. So I'm trying to create some kind of daylight feeling in night on the characters. And so, but the daylight would be from tungsten sources, yellow light or fluorescence at night. And obviously what you're talking about is, you know, you can implement gels and lighting, but it's also affected by what they're wearing, what the set looks like, or everybody has a different complexion. But the overall idea was how I would invert day for night and night for day. And so maybe what you're responding to is how the flesh tones look in these night scenes under artificial light. Now, it is true, I like to use, we've talked about it before, advancing and receding colors to create depth in the image. So like many of these situations he walks into are fluorescent situations, like in the beginning in the record store. And then on the fill light side, or not really, I never had like a key fill, but let's say on the side that would light part of the face, I might play with tungsten light, or I use quarter CTO, a warmer gel, just to offset the coldness of the environment. Because I always found that if you use one color in a scene, you lose, your eye loses seeing that color. You only really see a color if you play with the opposite of the color or the contrasting color. Then you see the color better of what you're presenting. So that's why I always try to play with contrasting colors rather than complementary colors to make that distinction. And obviously in Far From Heaven, you know, that was a very expressionistic, non-naturalistic, artifice, creating, you know, this artificial world. And so obviously the flesh tones change under the different color lighting, but it wasn't something I was specifically doing for the flesh tone. I was doing it more for the psychological look of the film.
Yes, I've prepared a few scenes, maybe if we'd like to watch them. And to warn you, of course, I discovered the strong Christian iconography in this film. So I chose three bed scenes, but only one is a sex scene or a love scene, mm-hmm. and the other ones
I don't have any problem with the sex scene.
Only with the other two. I mean, it has a lot to do with, yes, with burial and mourning and resurrection, but maybe we'll look at it. So there's three important...
Erection or resurrection?
Resurrection.
Oh, I see.
I'm sorry.
All right.
His deathbed, that was my first association. And of course the skin, very much looking like the saints or Christ figures in the history of painting. Did you look at the history of painting and especially the motif of...
Number one, Schrader, you know, was in the seminary, but all his films have a certain metaphysical quality to it. The color is kind of desaturated. So, yes, I understand how you think that it could have that aspect. But I think in all of Paul's films, there's these questions of faith. And... you know, be it that what I think the film's looking at is political action became terrorism, drugs became crack, you know, the promise of opening the doors to perception were lost, and sex became AIDS. So it was a loss to these kind of ideals, though, that we all believed the 60s was going to bring us, which obviously Paul was a product of. And myself to a greater or lesser extent. But I don't think we don't get into that. I mean, a lot has to do with the art direction, like even in the look of the last, you know, it's what you put in front of the camera that creates the images also. And so I work very strongly with production design to know what I'm going to be photographing, how I might implement what the set's going to look like. So a lot of the, you look at the colors he's wearing, you know, after you brought this up, he's wearing, you know, very putty, you know, pastel colors. That's not the right term. It's
beige, and browns.
Yeah, browns and beige. So that's all, plus his skin, you know, you're living in New York in the winter, you don't have a suntan. So obviously I'm not trying to use gels there to implement his flesh tone as being healthy. I probably used even something like a quarter minus green, or, you know, something to take a little color out of the flesh tone. Because you see the lamps in the background are a little warm, and I didn't warm up those lights. Sometimes I use yellow bulbs in a light fixture so they seem warm, but you don't know that they're yellow bulbs, to create a look in the lighting in the same room. So the only scene that I really could talk about, well, there's two things that are interesting what I saw that reminded me. That shot overhead when they're making love, you know, and I said to Paul, because in this film, there aren't real close-ups. They're all like medium shots, or, you know, what we consider medium close-up. So I said, isn't this the place where we really should get to a close-up? This is where they're coming together. This is, you know, this is like the most emotional part where he's going to try to make a connection in his life. And Paul looked at me and said, it's taken me years to get to a close-up. I'm not there yet. So I like that. And the last scene where, you know, obviously, you know, it's very mannered, this film, you know, so to have, and this painting really is in a hotel that we were going to shoot in that we couldn't shoot in, the Vermeer painting, you know, behind. So I was mimicking, I was playing the game to make the light look like Vermeer. And then the break in the color is, you didn't know it, but I'm saying to myself, there is a neon sign out the window that could create this kind of acerbic greenish blue that I thought was right emotionally when she leaves him in the morning. So that was the break visually, that you would feel this separation. So that was the idea there with the color and the... And then the framing is a bit mannered too, you know, his arm, his back, and the frame doesn't readjust. You know, I always like frames that encapsulate the feeling of the scene rather than, you know, close-up, medium, long shot, that I always like the way still photographers frame images, you know, for the image in itself, the relationship to objects in the frame. And I'll say this because my friend here is a great production designer, Jan Rolls, he lives in Holland, and he taught me something about images in a set, that a production designer just doesn't design a set, but understands how the camera will see the set, and that's the real mark of a great production designer, is that he creates images for you in the set for the camera. So it's different than, you know, creating a set for theater, that, you know, they understand the language of how the camera is going to see their set and the images and the characters in the set.
There's a rupture in the middle of the love scene. So at first we have the music and the crane shot, and it's like a ritualistic movement from the top shot and then coming down. It kind of reminded me of Pasolini's Mamma Roma, this movement of coming down over a body. I don't know if you watched it, if this was part of your film school lesson. Sorry.
I like you. I'm going to take you everywhere.
and then you have a cut, and it's quite hard because then you hear the sounds of New York streets,
right.
Just cars going by, and it's very... like a documentary all the magic is over of the right. of this love scene. It's all over, and then you have these shots. Maybe they're inspired by Antonioni, maybe they're inspired by Ozu, just looking at different things in this room. So, yes, and then you move on over the bed sheet, which is again in the magentas and the emerald green, which we saw in Far From Heaven. And then it's this moment where not only all the magic is gone, but Willem Dafoe's characters all left behind, and yes, so it's very, it's like an emotional choreography in this scene.
Yeah, well, like I say, some directors are visual and some aren't, and Paul is a very visual director, but in a very, in a manneristic way, you know, in a formalistic way, and so he thinks of shots that have this kind of almost Brechtian style. You know, there's always kind of a distance to the character. When he was kidding me and saying, I haven't gotten to a close-up, I mean, that's the truth. You know, he sees things from a certain emotional distance, and that's what he's translating with the characters, this emotional distance.
And could you say something again about the magenta and the emerald green. You've talked about this already and the contrasting colors, but
well, there are two contrasts. The we all know as cinematographers here that the opposite of green is magenta. So that's what I did. The opposite of yellow is blue. The opposite of red is cyan. Those are things we play with when we time a film to create a look. So I just use that information that I knew. That if I played with that, it could feel there'd be some separation, and it would create this this, you know, emotional feeling that I felt, because there's been a lot of studies. I said there's a lot of studies about, and painters studied this, like Joseph Albers in a contemporary sense, but even before him, there's been many studies about how color affects the viewer. You know, like, restaurants usually are in warm colors, except fish restaurants, they make blue.
But, and no, Greek restaurants, they're
maybe green, yeah. But they found that that isn't like an appetizing color for people's appetite. And a lot of hospitals have green because that's a restful color. So I don't know. That you can think about all that and.
You've been assistant to Vittorio Storaro also.
Well, and, he's but, bullshit.
But
you, know?
You seem to have... You seem
you know,
to
Victoria's
have
made his own colors.
I know.
You know. The mother is blue. The father is yellow. I mean, come on. He thinks he invented color. But we all respect him for what he brought to our profession and gave us a certain respect.
But so you're not using it in a symbolistic way?
No,
it's not
I think
a coded
that
system
no,
that you
I, that's,
use? It's
that's, I'll leave that to Victoria to do it. No, it's fine. No, everybody, I try to do it. I try to use color the way I've understood color through painting, through the way painters have used color. And studied color, and that it has certain effects on the viewer.
Yes, there's of course Albers, as you said, interaction of colors, and the always two colors, how they go together, and the physical and the psychological part of it.
Yeah, so I try to play with that.
Yes.
But I don't tell the director because then I'll say,
you just do it. So Schrader wasn't very comfortable with
there wasn't any discussion. I don't know, kind of like you do your thing, he does his thing, and, you know, he sets the shot up. But I don't think he... Actually, the color monitors weren't good that good back then, so they didn't know what you were doing. Actually, they were black and white, actually. That's come to think of it. They were black and white monitors, so they really didn't know what you were doing, so that was good.
There's another interesting thing I would like to ask you, which is in the first scene, or most prominent in the first scene that we saw. It's a kind of a linking between the body and the voice. And we see that he has different means of expressing himself. He's writing, and we hear the lyrics by Michael Biehn, so there's a singing voice, which also seems to be his voice. And even though if he's not speaking directly, we have at least, the writing, the voice over, and the lyrics. So there's, without the direct dialogue, there's three levels. And his skin, maybe I'm overdoing it, but his skin looks, I'm sure I am. It looks like paper, you know? It looks like paper, like the white paper he's writing on. So I had the idea that all the voices that you are kind of writing something interior that is projected on his body. And I was wondering how you worked with the script to find images for a character that doesn't speak, but has a voice, but that comes later in the editing. So I think you've done something similar in The Limey.
I'll say it this way. You know, first there's the script, then the script isn't the film, and then, and then there's the shooting. And you go in with a game plan for the shooting, but the truth of the matter is you're just trying to get through the day, you know, because you have a schedule. But obviously you go in with certain visual ideas that you've discussed, but it's not something that you are constantly discussing on the set when you're that day that you're shooting. But then the next part of the filmmaking process is the editing. And a lot of the ideas that you had when you're shooting don't always end up in the editing, and some ideas that you never even had in the shooting end up in the editing. So the wonderful thing about the process of filmmaking is that it's these different stages that create ultimately what the end product is. And you know, it's great that you see all these things in it now, but I honestly, I can't say those were conscious decisions. It was just, yes, maybe his body has this like marble-like look, but it was just purely like, I think because of the set was so devoid of color, and maybe the lighting had a certain translucence to it just because of the, again, the lack of color in it around him. And then you can read in whatever you want to what he's writing or how it's written on him or psychologically. I mean, that's the strength of images, that it has a nonverbal level of communication. That's what we always hope for, that images can be open-ended enough that the viewer completes the image and the idea. So I welcome your thoughts. And let's make a film together.
No, it's okay. And we're open for questions, so if you have questions, please, anytime, raise your hand. Yes.
Can I get the mic?
It's not a question, but it's a remark, because you were talking about colors and the feeling of colors and the contrast, what you said, and the contrast, if everything is dark, the eyes open up and looks brighter than it should be, it looks grayish. I think that's the same also with colors, of course. There are certain colors the brain remembers, like the blue sky. Everybody, the brain knows how the blue sky looks, or green from the foliage or from grass. And it's a little bit the same thing with the skin tone, because this is a very normal thing. You're always in your life, you're connected with people, and you know how the skin tone is looking like. So it's a difference, of course, when you have a room with a closed window. It's a room, and the room is somehow in a certain color. It's lit in a certain color, whatever. So, and you have a long scene in that colorized room, and after a minute or something, the eyes adapt and they don't realize anymore that there's a certain magenta feeling in this room because they adapt to that color. The moment you open up the windows and you look, it's the same room. You open up the window, you can see a tree outside with a green, so the eye can adapt, oh yes, that's the green, I know, this is the green, and you keep the feeling of the contrasty color in the room, because there is always something you remember and which is in relationship to that color. It's the same what you said before with darkness and brightness. So when it's a room, it's just dark, it needs a bulb hanging from the ceiling or something so that you can continue with a feeling of darkness. Nice. Very interesting question what you brought up.
According to the color, when I saw this movie, which is really excellent lighted, I thought about what could I imagine, or could you imagine to do this movie in black and white and have all the colors which you're talking about in black and white tonality? Because I thought several times in the other movies we have seen here that these are basically sometimes it's a tonality of black and white what you're using. What do you think about? Did Paul ever think about working in black and white? For we know so many tonalities of color in the recent film noirs in black and white.
1, 2, 3.
It's interesting. I've never discussed it with him. Obviously, there's always the problem about shooting in black and white because for distribution, it won't end up on television. Because, people think their television set's broken if it's in black and white. But it's interesting, you're right, he did reference black and white films to make this film. The convention now is you shoot in color, let's say like Alexander Payne did in Nebraska, and then they take all the color out and it's black and white, but it's not really black and white, because when you use filters in black and white, you can control different parts of the set or the landscape because of the color of the gels. You you can make dark the sky or change, if red, you can use a filter to make the red darker or lighter. So you don't really do that in post successfully in black and white. I don't know. I don't have an answer to that, if he would have been interested to shoot black and white. But I know it makes it more and more difficult to shoot in black and white. Because, when I did I'm Not There, Todd wanted to reference black and white and shoot in black and white. And there was one lab left to do it. And I at first I was like, it would be so much easier to shoot in color because the film stock is much faster in color than the older stock double X negative that was available, that they still make, that was like 200 ASA or 160. But then I realized it when we finished the film and we went through a digital intermediate, that the grain structure would never be the same if you shot in color and then you transferred it to look black and white. And also the contrast ratio is different in color film than the older black and white film. So for the grain reasons, the contrast, but then something else that was very interesting was the colorist told me that she could get a truer black and white even though it was being printed on color stock, because we went from a digital intermediate into a film stock, than if we started in color. Now today I know they can take out the color totally because it's a digital media that you're looking at the image in. But back then it wasn't. And she had just finished a film, I can say, Control, that they shot in color and desaturated to black and white. And she had a hard time because when it would go in the bath back then, even if you tried to make it look black and white, it would pick up the color of whatever the bath was. So it was hard to get a true black and white. Today you don't have that problem, but it definitely will look different.
I was wondering, seeing the entire film and also Emma's apartment, the way it's made, and of course the use of colors, we've said so much about it, but I was wondering if there was also a connection to Kenneth Anger, the inauguration of the Pleasure Dome and Samson de Brière and the entire circle, because the whole film reminds me of this coloring somehow.
Oh, she thinks the whole film references Kenneth Anger?
No, not the entire film, but the apartment.
Because it was playing on the TV, right?
Yeah.
There's this clip on the television also, but...
Oh, no, I didn't see that, no, but...
but it is Kenneth Anger, yes. You're very good.
What is it? What?
It's Scorpio Rising.
Yeah, Scorpio Rising, on the, yes. Yeah. Oh, no, I think that was just Paul referencing this kind of crazy filmmaking of the 60s again, you know, because the whole film is about loss. It's about the separation of these people and somehow them trying to regain something or not lose, you know. I mean, he's worried about his future, you know.
There's a strong difference. It doesn't really look like Warhol's factory where they live. It looks more like a very bourgeois surrounding.
Yeah,
so they've become old.
Yeah, she's living in an Upper East Side apartment. You know, he's dealing drugs to, like, rich kids on the East Side. You know, it's the whole scene's changed.
Are there any more questions?
I'm interested in your questions.
You want some more? Maybe it's something very general. Was this film an important film for you in your career?
Oh, let me think. It was 1992. No, look, obviously to work with someone like Paul Schrader I did another film with him, Touch. Was a great...
which never had a release here.
It's kind of an interesting film. It's someone that gets the stigmata and then loses it because he falls in love with this country and Western singer. No, I mean, he is one of the great, you know, writer-directors. I always said in a weird way, of course I wish this wasn't on camera, I think his scripts in other people's hands are many times stronger because, again, he's interested in something other than just this emotional connection between the characters, this kind of separation and isolation, and I think that makes it difficult for a lot of viewers to participate in the story. You know, like Taxi Driver, I mean, Marty Scorsese makes all his films so visceral and so in your face that, you know, you're very moved by the story. And with Paul, which, you know, I think is his strength, is that he has this kind of intellectual approach towards storytelling that he wants you to respond to, again, I say in a Brechtian way, more than a cinematic, you know, emotional, you know, more conventional way. And that's what makes him an interesting filmmaker.
And there are a few film historical references in this film. You talked about Antonioni's L'Eglise. Did you, on special occasions or short, make direct references, or how did you? You developed an overall visual idea for this film, which is very strong. So there seems to be a very strong concept, which is, of course, cooperation between you and Schrader, but maybe you could tell us a little bit how it went about and how you prepared and got to that result.
Well, like I said, the one thing we did is look at early Antonioni, look at it, L'Avventura and Eclipse and La Nota, and you know, the strength of how he tells a story with images, you know. It was, and for me, Antonioni always was interested in the landscape of the characters, you know, that the environment, the world around these characters become who the characters are. So that's what we're really referencing, Antonioni. And also this idea of, like, the camera, like I say, it was up a little over his shoulder following him many times, you know, and whose point of view is that? So... And so it was just that Antonioni had this idea of, like, how the camera could be independent of the action and create the psychological state for the characters, or that there'd be visual metaphors in his imagery, like at the end of Eclipse is so beautiful, when at the end when they're walking through these empty streets. And, well, that was something, yeah, I guess I could, a reference of, like, you're in a city, but we've taken people out of the city, so you're making it like their own world. Antonioni would do that. You know, you'd be in a city or in a countryside or whatever, and there wasn't anybody around. It was just the characters on that set, on that location, and that creates a certain psychological isolation. So I just think, in a weird way, we're trying to create this isolation with the characters of the what's in the frame has a certain architectural feeling, but it's in relation to our character, not designing it around everything else that would have really been in that reality. Oh, I got a phone.
It's not
actually my brother, but it's all right.
So would you say that is maybe something that is important for you, not only in filming this movie, but also other movies, creating a closeness to the characters, in getting involved in the character's psychology through distancing? Because you also said that Schrader didn't feel very comfortable with a close-up, and do you prefer medium and long shots and distances to?
I think every film has to have its own language, and. So I don't necessarily carry one idea to every film. I try to create those ideas with the director, the art director, the actors, you know, like what is the film expressing, and find the best language to support those ideas. And like I said before here, that, you know, the camera is point of view in the storytelling, and that's very important for directors to understand where they put the cameras, where we as the audience are going to perceive and understand those characters. Who, you know, so I always think it's interesting to go in and think about whose point of view are we seeing the scene from. You know, as mentioned, you know, Hollywood might want to see it from everybody's point of view and decide how to create it later in the editing room. But I don't think that makes it better, unless, you know, it's stronger if you understand what you're doing it to begin with.
I mean, you don't, listen, you don't always know exactly how it's going to work, but you go in, if you go in with a strong idea in the beginning, you have a chance to succeed.
So if you think about documentary work and about work on fiction films and the collaboration you have to do and you are definitely doing every time with the director and with other departments, and think about the possibilities, all the technical tools you have today and you can use, do you think it's easier as it was, let us say, 20, 30 years ago, to paint and to sculpture light, to decide how camera movements will be done with all these possibilities developed in within the last decades, mm-hmm. And even if you have the digital possibilities now, do you think it's easier, this cooperation and finding out what you want to get, or is it more difficult now?
Well, I think there's always kind of a romantic notion that it was better in the old days, all right? So, but now that everybody can see what's being created because you have a video tap and that's supposedly what you're getting, what it does is it now includes more people in the choices that you would have had more of a selective process in making. So in a lot of ways it is more complicated for cinematographers to create images for the director. It doesn't have to be that way. It's just if it's used wrongly. I guess that's the way I would say it. We were talking about light, you know. I was saying, you know, in a lot of ways, digital films, on average, look a lot more interesting than the average film used to look like, unless, you know, there was exceptional craft people creating those images with a good director. Now I think more mediocre filmmakers can make images look better because, you know, they see it in their digital monitor and they say, well, there's an image there. But like I say, you have to understand, just because it's dark doesn't make it interesting. You know, it's the balance of the shadow to the contrast to the light, and that you should have a mid-range, a highlight, and shadow area, even in a dark scene. And if you make it just dark, it looks like mud. But, you know, there's a whole kind of machismo attitude about lighting that, like, oh, I can do it dark, you know, and the director goes along with it because they think they're doing Gordon Willis or somebody. But Gordon Willis was the first person to say, you know, I leave the blinds bright in the background against the shadow area. So, I always said it's not the technical aspect that improves our filmmaking. It's the stories we tell and how we interpret that stories through the camera. You know, like I said, a very simple film. The camera never moves. This Polish film, Ida, you know, which is beautifully composed and told and just seems to be always placing the camera in the right place to tell the story. You know, it's finding the camera for the psychology of what the scene is about. You know, that's a very hard thing to explain, why you put it where you put it, you know, but I say you go back to like understanding the point of view of the storytelling to understand where to put the camera. And not every film isn't the same. Obviously, if you're shooting a special effects or an action film, you need the coverage because that language needs cuts, but not every film needs the same thing.
I have a question. Would you like to shoot a 3D film?
Absolutely not. I did one for this, whatever it was, Cathedral of Culture. It was a nightmare. Now they can shoot 2D and make it 3D. But my problem with shooting real 3D was it takes the whole process. It sets filmmaking back about 50 years ago. You go to set a shot, the light is just perfect. You know, we're talking about an exterior lighting. And then you have to have this guy come in and figure the convergence out of the lens, and this other guy coming in and looking at this. You have like so many people between you and what you do, you've lost the light by the time they say it's ready. So I found it totally frustrating. Or if the camera's moving, they say, oh, you're too close to that object. You can't be that close. So it's very labor intensive. But now, and I don't really think the 3D brings the viewer more into the film. I think you can create those kind of images without 3D. I just think it's a, you know.
You were just talking about editing. I think there's also there's a real danger. This is about the job of the editor. What is he about? So is he, let's say, you are shooting a very nice, well choreographed, floating move. You have the whole scene from wide, and you get through close-ups and mediums and wherever, and you end up in a wide shot again, or something like that. The editor would say, what shall I do? I can cut the end and the beginning and put the next shot on it. No, that's not my job. I want to edit. And so, you got some coverage. Oh, this is one. Let me see the coverage. Oh, I can put this part in here, put this part in there. So this is my job. Now it's well edited. And the nice choreographed flow of the shot is lost. So this is a real danger, and it happens very often. And it happens, of course, more in the Hollywood pictures, where you are forced to shoot a lot of coverage. And then the editor says, okay, then let me use it. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't need it, he is using it, and he's destroying the way the director, the cinematographer, had in mind as it should look.
Well, That brings back the point that if you don't have a strong director that has a strong visual idea, then you're left to the vagaries of whoever, you know, is the strong one at that moment. And if the editor is the strong one at the end of the process, then he's going to impose what he thinks. But, I mean, it's not always the case that the editor destroys what you do. Sometimes this is what I would say. When you shoot a film, you create a certain rhythm in how you shoot the film, with editing or not. I mean, with the shots or not the editing yet, but the way you construct the language, the shots. And in editing, they can either implement that rhythm or they can break that rhythm. So you need a director that understands why he's doing what he's doing to create that rhythm to tell the story with your images. So it's so true. Our images only exist because how they're constructed later. And, you know, I know most cinematographers, we like the extended shot, but that isn't always the best way to tell the story. But it all depends on the director that you're working with. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, and I've tried to do this, a cameraman can't make the film for the director, and if the director doesn't understand what you're doing, you know, all the shots can look great, you know, and then if he doesn't, you know, understand what the idea was behind it, then it won't be realized. I mean, your best work is going to be with the best directors.
I think this is a very nice and
fitting closing statement, because we really have to wrap up because we have things to prepare, and I like to take the opportunity to thank Ed once again for being here, for sharing his ideas, his knowledge, his experience, his humor with us over these 2 days, and we're so glad and that you were here, and thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.